Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. We at New Dimensions thank you for your support. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Novelist and poet Mary Mackey tells us that she was possibly the only student at North Central High School in Indianapolis, Indiana, ever to be sent to the principal's office for being in illicit possession of a collection of poems by William Blake. She began writing poems when she was 11 years old and longed to leave the provinciality of Indianapolis. She's stimulated by what she was reading regarding other places in the world, but mostly she got her knowledge of things beyond her geography by her fevered dreams. As a child, she suffered from high fevers that would take her body temperature to over 105 degrees. These fevered bouts would take her into hallucinogenic states of consciousness. Later, in the jungles of Costa Rica and Brazil, she again experienced bouts of high fevers and wrote many poems regarding the places she traveled in these altered states of consciousness. Today, we'll be exploring the poems that resulted from these travels of these mind-expanding states with our guest, Mary Mackey. Mary Mackey is a novelist, screenwriter, and poet. She's professor emeritus of English and former writer in residence at California State University, Sacramento. During her 20s, she lived in the rainforests of Costa Rica. Recently, she's been traveling to Brazil, incorporating her experiences in the tropical rainforests into her fiction and poetry. She's the author of many books of poetry, and her historical novels include her Earth Song series that covers the lives of the people of Neolithic Europe. Her most recent book of poetry, The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, New and Selected Poems, 1974 through 2018, has won the prestigious 2019 Eric Hoffer Book Award. Join us for the next hour as we explore the tropical jungle that exists both outside and within with our guest, Mary Mackey. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Mary, welcome.
I'm glad to be here, Justine. Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you here and talking about poetry and dreams and fevered dreams and all sorts of mystical things. I would love for you to go back. One thing that struck me, after you got this award, you were, which is very prestigious, you were invited back to Harvard to at a speaker's. And I was struck by the idea that when you were at Harvard, there were two things that happened. One, you were
I guess, an undergraduate mm-hmm. when Atwood was there at Harvard. And her Handmaiden Tales really reflect.
Yeah, they're set at Harvard and Cambridge. In fact, Harvard Yard is the site of the Eye, you know, the Secret Service. And it appears in Testaments, and it appears in The Handmaid's Tale. Yeah, so it was all very familiar geographically to me.
And I thought it was interesting, as you were in Harvard, two things. There was one, there was only one creative writing course.
There was only one creative writing course, and people thought that should probably be abolished because you shouldn't really teach creative writing. It was competitive. You had to submit. So my junior year, I submitted to it, and I was the only woman accepted in my class in the whole university for the creative writing course. So it was Mary and 20 men, you know.
And the other thing is that at that time, because you were a woman, mm-hmm. you were not allowed in the Lamont Library.
No, the Harvard's undergraduate library, we were banned from it. In fact, when I found my old Radcliffe handbook a little while ago, it's not even listed as a place we can go. So, no, we were not allowed in. And rumor had it, I don't know if it was true because I never got in there, that if women worked there, they had to go down special hallways so they couldn't be seen. And I'm willing to believe that. And the problem with Lamont was it had Harvard's big poetry room and poetry collection where all the readings were, which meant as a young poet, I never could hear the famous people like Allen Ginsberg and, you know, Robert Frost, who read at Harvard because they read in Lamont. So no women were allowed in Lamont. And I was refused entry. And also, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was refused entry. She was not an undergraduate. She was, I think, in law school at the time. So I feel very kind of, you know, wonderful and honored that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and I have something in common because she's one of my heroes, yeah. that we were both prohibited from entering Lamont Library.
How did that affect you in your writing and in your life?
Well, you know, I thought at the time and later that it was very detrimental because, you know, you come to college when you're 17. I had no mentors. I had very little creative writing guiding. I wasn't allowed in the library where the poetry was. But in retrospect, as I've gotten older, I think it might have been one of the best things that ever happened to me, because if I had been allowed to take, you know, had mentors at Harvard, if I'd been allowed to go to seminars where I was taught, I was a very, you know, conscientious kind of goody-two-shoes student. I would have written poetry just like the famous male writers were writing. Instead, I write this strange, different, very original poetry that I had to invent myself from the ground up. And I think it was probably the greatest gift Harvard gave me. It gave me accidentally.
It reminds me of one of your poems. Uh-huh. Shakespeare, and it was a poem of Juliet.
Yes.
Because I think that this kind of is reflective a bit of what you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. Okay. It's called Juliet. And this is a series of poems called that I was going to publish. This was written in the early 70s, late 60s. And these were part of the second wave women's movement. These were some of the first poems, you know, that I wrote and that became part of that movement. And these are Shakespeare's women talking back. And I was going to put out a whole book called A Threatening Letter to Shakespeare, but it became instead a section in The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. So this is Juliet. I was a green girl, 14 and fresh, my breasts curled so tight in my chest that they ached. Time pulled through my body like sap, and I thought love grew everywhere like milkweed. Romeo was a human swagger. We drove over the state line near the end of spring and were married by a judge in striped pajamas who loaned us a cigar band for a ring. I said, look how the dogwood is in bloom, like the lips of small children in the naked woods. And Romeo said, let's stop for a cheeseburger. I said, when I see a river, I imagine a mouth at the end that could have swallowed us both. I said, this is the beginning of a great adventure. I said, I've escaped into love, and I'll never be unhappy again. But there was wax to take off the kitchen floor and diapers to wash, and Romeo snored, and I found that love grows around the heart like the bark on a tree, and we had three children, and nobody died, and you can wait forever for the balcony scene.
I love that. I mean, it's like, here's what happens after we live happily ever after with Prince Charming. Whatever,
right.
You know.
This is life that comes back and, you know, changes our illusions and makes us see reality.
Beyond Disney. Right.
Beyond Disney. And, you know, the other women who speak in here are Ophelia, Desdemona, Lady Macbeth, you know, Cleopatra. And so I really liked having that the other side of the history of women filled in.
Right. And doing it in poetry. How does poetry differ from prose? Like when you write novels, historical novels, mm-hmm. how does that differ from
the process or
yes.
how it feels?
How it feels.
Poetry is faster. It's not faster ultimately because I spend a great deal of time revising. But the first draft, the thing that comes to me, it comes to me often with an image or something, and I write it out in longhand, and I write everything that comes into my mind, and then I do extreme amounts of cutting and revising and paring it down. But it flows from a kind of inner level that's wordless, that's images, that's an almost mystical level that is kind of outside of the ordinary reality. Prose is a much more logical thing. It has some of these aspects, you know, when you're thinking of plot and scenes and things. It takes 2 years at least to write a novel. And a historical novel, a lot of that is just library research. It's like writing a doctoral dissertation. You go to the library and, you know, you find everything. And so it's a very sustained process. You do it over and over again. And you have to keep track of a huge amount of stuff. I mean, physically, it's like being the organizer for a big conference with people from all over. And you have to remember who they are and where they sit and everything. Oh. So, you know, that's a novel writing is a very long, long logical process. Then you have to remember everything when you revise, and if you change something at one point, you have to go back and change everything else. A poem is a strike to the heart, you know. It's just much, much more intense and less logical.
And in receiving a poem, say something about how when we read it, mm-hmm. hopefully we read it out loud. I mean, I know for me, I read it first. Mm-hmm. I just read it just mm-hmm. on the page. And then if it strikes me, if there's something about it that grabs me mm-hmm. on some level, then I'll read it to myself out loud.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful way to do it.
And why is that? Tell us.
Why is that a wonderful way to do it? Because when you read something to yourself, you hear it twice. You hear it in your mind and you hear it in your ears. And when you hear it twice, you hear it as two people in some ways. And it speaks to different parts of you. The mind part speaks to the inner part of you, and the ear parts too speak to the outer part of you. And suddenly you have they come together. And for a moment in that poem, you have a unity. And a good poem, a really good poem, is the kind of thing that allows you to have a feeling of the inspiration of the poet. It lets you think as the poet thought or feel as the poet thought for a brief moment. Now, not all poetry is written that way. A lot of poetry, particularly modern poetry, is written to be only read on the page. It does things with typeface, and it's meant to be like a crossword puzzle. It's a very logical thing, and it plays with words as building blocks, like chess. That's not what my poetry does. My poetry is about imagery. It's about suggesting the wordless. It's about taking you to a kind of a view of reality that's just a little different, or maybe greatly different than what you're seeing, and that I believe exists around us. But a lot of modern poetry is highly logical and academic, and I'm just not that kind of poet.
Well, and that's not the kind of poetry that appeals to me.
Mm-hmm.
In my personal preference.
Yeah, I respect it, but I don't write it, and I don't read much of it because it's not the way I'm more Blakean. I'm more, you know, more of the poetry of the unknown than the poetry of the known and the reasoned.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Mary Mackey, and she is a poet and a novelist and a screenwriter, and she is the author of this new anthology of poetry, The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, New and Selected Poems, 1974 through 2018. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, marymackey.com, and she spells her name M-A-C-K-E-Y, M-A-C-K-E-Y, marymackey.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Tones. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Mary Mackey, and she is the author of The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. It's a book of poetry from 1974 through 2018, the winner of the Eric Hoffer Book Award. And that was wonderful. I mean, what a surprise.
Yes.
I mean, how rare it is, as a small press book. Mm-hmm. The winner, the top of it, the one winner. It wasn't like...
Right, it wasn't just poetry books. It was the best small press book of 2019. I mean, that's what the award was for.
Yeah, and so what a wonderful acknowledgement.
It was really... I was honored. I felt very happy. And also I felt that what meant most to me was that somebody saw the poetry and understood it, which mm-hmm. was really important to me.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back. We were talking briefly about the writing, the difference mm-hmm. between writing a novel and writing poetry. But in both kinds of writing, there's something that you do, a creative trance. I'd love for you to describe that.
Right. I'd be happy to. When I was younger, even in my teens, I read a lot of biographies of writers, and many of them had bad endings, you know, suicide, very bad drug abuse, alcoholism. And I realized that they were trying to get through to their unconscious material and that they were doing it in ways that ultimately stopped them from writing. And I thought there's got to be a better way to do this. And, you know, I had had very high fevers, which had allowed me to see that kind of world and the kind of thing you could get to. But I wanted to get there in a way that wouldn't destroy me and destroy my ability to write. So I started out working on a way to go into a light trance where I could move into my unconscious, I could get material out of my unconscious, and then I could bring it back up and remember it. The problem with unconscious material is you can't remember it. It's like you have a dream, you wake up, it's for a moment, it's vivid in your mind, but it's not stored in your long-term memory, and so you forget it. And what I figured out is how I could, in a calm and peaceful and, you know, healthy way, move deeply into my unconscious, get material, and, you know, work on it and come back up with it and remember it and write it down. And this is a technique I developed. And I used all sorts of little things. I drew on self-hypnosis, theta cycles, neurophysiology. I was very influenced by Proust's remembrance of things past, surrealist techniques of automatic writing. I did all that. And then this very light kind of trance thing where you stand, it's called liminal, you know, where you stand on the threshold between the dream world and the regular world, and you have a foot in each side, and you can participate in each way. So I want to go to that wordless space before words exist. I want the words to bubble up and to come to me, and then I want to be able to take them back to consciousness. I also want to say something, that after you come back with that, that's not a poem. What you need to do is craft it. And I'm very, you know, then rational crafting. I use all the techniques of craft, all the education I had, everything I've read, and I revise a great deal. I cut a huge amount. I've had poems that were a page long that ended up two lines, and they were the better for it. So it's not just that you're coming up with word salad. You know, you're coming up with a lot of stuff, but then you have to mold it and shape it and turn it into a work of art.
Well, I know it's not, you're not talking about a meditative process.
No.
You're not talking about a prayer process.
No.
You're not talking about self-hypnosis.
No.
You know, it's something else. And you mentioned briefly about you learned some things through these fevered states.
Mm-hmm.
And in those fevered states, you're talking about if the body temperature goes over 105, it's something happens.
Yeah, something happens to you. Over 105, what happens is, this is the first time I probably experienced this, I was 6 months old and nearly died. I turned blue, and my father was working in a military hospital, and they had penicillin, which wasn't available to civilians. I was given penicillin, and my life was saved. So it's all gravy for me. I mean, life for me is just an extra plus. You know, I would have been an infant mortality statistic. So the time I remember was when I was 3, and I had a very high fever, and then I started seeing things, and kind of the world became very thin. Up to 105, fever is utterly miserable. You feel just as bad as you can imagine. When you start getting over 105, you start feeling, you know, toward 106, you feel better. I have run up to almost 107, which is just about as high as you can go without brain damage, assuming I don't have brain damage. We know. And when I get to that state, I can't speak for everybody, but when I get to that state, I feel wonderful. I feel happy. I crack jokes. I feel no fear of death. People are, of course, around me are crazy with fear because they think I'm dying. And I say, don't worry, it's going to be fine. I'm okay. You know, and
do you have any visuals?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I see just objects floating around, or I see the world go kind of thin, and I see, when I was a child, I saw other children, and I saw them, I saw trees in winter with golden leaves, and, you know, I see things sometimes. Mostly it's a kind of very euphoric thing, and I start talking in rhymed couplets. And I have witnesses. I have talked in rhymed couplets for up to 4 hours. And unable to stop when I have these really, really high fevers. It's very strange, but they just go on and on. I've talked to neurophysiologists, all sorts of people about it. I mean, I don't claim I'm like some kind of prophet or, you know, seeing into the other world, but I can tell you that there's something that your brain does when it gets that high that makes reality look very thin, and you see all sorts of other things that you don't see otherwise.
Do you recall those couplets when you come out of it?
No, there's no way I can recall them. Nobody's writing them down because they're trying to get my fever down.
Yeah.
You know, so nobody's writing them down. But I do often come out of fevers, even somewhat low-grade fevers now with poems, because I get these crystallized images. I get these little images. They aren't words. And then it's like you drop a crystal into a supersaturated solution, and the poem crystallizes out of the images. So sometimes that will happen. And so I'll write the image down, and then when I go back to it and go into a light trance state, the image will expand, and it will expand itself into words and into a poem.
You give an example in one of your writings that I read. I think it was an essay about the creative trance state, where when you were writing The Village of Bones, which is part of Earth Song series of novels, you said that the sea goddess, there was no images of Neolithic goddesses at that time. So you were making this up, and that's when you went into a trance.
Right. Yeah, there actually are images of goddesses at that time, but this was my particular goddess who was going to rise out live from the ocean. And we don't have, you know, there was no color to it or anything. So I didn't want to do a statue image. So I had made up a name for her, Amapá. And so that's a part of Brazil, Amoná. Amoná comes out of the ocean and walks on the water toward my heroine at the beginning of this book. It's a kind of annunciation where she's going to tell her that she's going to have a baby. So I went into a light trance, and I started just sort of repeating the name to myself. And then these things started coming, and I started seeing that she had green seaweed-like hair, and she was wearing coral rings on her toes, and, you know, that she had eyes that were all colors. They were the color of the sea and all eyes. And she just began sort of materializing in front of me, and the images kept coming up, and the words kept coming up. And then by the end of it, I had a character I could talk to, and I never write a novel until I've summoned up a character and I can talk to her. You know, now I don't think I don't know if I'm channeling things. I'm not making any claims of doing that. But what I do know is that if I can imagine a character well enough to talk to her, I can write a novel about her. I think this is a way of getting into the imagination, of unlocking that door, that all that stuff is in everybody's brains, but you don't have the key to the cabinet.
You mentioned Amapá, and that just reminds me of another poem that really goes back to maybe this time in Brazil. Is that right?
Yes.
And can you describe where this poem came from?
This is called The Invisible Forest of Amapá. Amapá is a part of Brazil that, when I wrote the poem, was 90% untouched. The rainforest was completely intact there. And I called it invisible because it was invisible to Europeans because they hadn't mapped it. Obviously, indigenous people knew where it was. And it had the greatest resource of endangered species and untouched rainforest in the Amazon. And now this is the place that's being burned over. And so it's very, it's a very short poem. I'd be happy to read it.
Please.
If you like. And it's, it was a refuge of beauty, really. And this is a major concern of mine. I did live in the jungles of Costa Rica and the Amazon, and I've been interested in ecological issues since 1966. So this has been a long haul. This is called The Invisible Forests of Amapá. Crested capuchin, nectar bat, three-toed sloth, golden lion tamarin, red-handed howling monkey, dark-throated seed-eater, blue-winged macaw, great rivers veiled in steam, 60 billion trees reaching toward a sky so green it burns like copper.
So that really, that's where the poem, it just takes us with our breath away to see it through the eyes of someone seeing this pristine
jungle
knowing it's being burned, especially now.
I think of myself, I think of one of my missions or duties as a poet now, in this time, is to preserve as a witness the beauty of the old planet, the planet that we're losing, and to write it for future generations. I see a lot of my poetry as being written for future generations.
I'm wondering then if you can share with us one of the poems, the fever. Which one was it?
Breaking the Fever.
Breaking the Fever. Because this really goes back to what we were talking about, these fevered states that mm-hmm. you have experienced,
right. Which has happened about 8 times to me, I think, in my mm-hmm. life. I was trying to count them up the other day, and recently too, fairly recently. Breaking the Fever. When I was young, fevers were attacked. The grown-ups would rub you with alcohol, wrap you in wet sheets, refuse you blankets, fan you, feed you aspirin, plunge your wrists in cold water. They knew fever had to be fought because it let children see forbidden things. At 105, I would start to hear voices soft and lulling. At 106, the faces would appear swimming around me. Stretching out their hands, they would gesture to me to join them. I was always very happy then, floating out on the warm brink of the world. The fever children would sing in high voices, liquid like silver bells. Come with us, they'd say. Come play, Mary. And they'd show me maple trees turning red and gold, long aisles of sunlight and woods that glowed and trembled. My body would start to come apart very gently, like milkweed fluff, and I'd begin to rise up toward their hands, but always at the last moment, the dark circles of the grown-ups' faces would force me back down, and their fear would pin my chest to the mattress like black crystal paperweights. They would force more aspirin on me, more ice and alcohol rubs, more wet sheets, and if that didn't work, they would lift my naked body and plunge it into a tub of cold water, ignoring my screams. Come back, they'd plead. Come back, come back. And my fever would buckle and snap like the spine of a beautiful snake crushed under a boot. Then the fever children would abandon me, and I'd be left in a world of ordinary things, light bulbs, used Kleenex, hissing radiators, thermometers. I'd see my mother's pale, terrified face, and my stuffed animals, and my brother's crib, and my precious fever would lie broken in 1,000 bits, with no way to put it back together, and I could never explain how kind it had been, how foolish we were to fear it.
That was Mary Mackey reading Breaking the Fever. And I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Mary Mackey, author of The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, and it's a book of selected poems from 1974 to 2018. I wanted to go back to your time.